This Week on The Score, a conversation with congressional candidate Thomas O. We talk to a historian about the First World War. A free market economist explains the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. All this and more on The Score. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Election Day is not even 2 weeks away. So far this campaign season, we have heard from congressional candidates Ben Klein and Jennifer Lewis, Dave Bratt and Abigail Spanberger and Joe Walton, Denver Riggleman and Leslie Coburn, and Pete Wells. This week we chat with Thomas O., the Republican candidate in Virginia's 8th Congressional District, who is challenging incumbent Democrat Don Beyer. The district is not friendly to Republicans, with the last GOP congressional victory in 1988, 30 years ago. I caught up with Mr. O., a U.S. Army veteran and son of immigrants from Korea, at the busy Republican headquarters in Fairfax last weekend. Tell me about yourself. Tell me about your background and what made you decide to run for Congress this year.
Okay. Well, Rick, my name is Thomas O. I'm the Republican nominee running in the 8th Congressional District. I was born and raised here in Northern Virginia, Fairfax County product, went to Centerville High School. I consider myself like a 1.5 generation Korean American. My family immigrated to the United States. I enlisted into the military straight out of high school, then I went to George Mason University, local here in Northern Virginia as well. So I spent time on active duty, became an officer, just recently separated from active duty last year, Army. I did supply when I was enlisted, became an infantry officer, Army Airborne Ranger, and now I do psychological operations in the reserves, and I'm basically a recently transitioned veteran. And before leaving my job, I resigned. I was basically working as a federal contractor in the project management, program management field, helping wounded sailors and Marines for Navy medicine. So I know all about come time June for me, spend that money. I'm trying to help change that concept. But I always had an interest on, you know, doing something bigger and helping your communities and making a bigger impact. That's why I decided to join the military straight out of high school, because I thought there were really big problems in the world. And I guess I'm young and naive. I'm going to go help solve all the problems, try to be a superhero, I guess. But after leaving the military, I moved back home. Northern Virginia is the only area that I could really call home. And I just saw there was a lot of things going on. First of all, we're so polarized, and I think that's unfortunate. I think I'm a big fan of John McCain. We should do what's best for the American people at the end of the day. And in the military, I learned to think objectively. You don't make decisions based on emotions and do what's best for your subordinates, not for your own political gain or your personal career. I saw that a lot of politicians were doing that. Politicians are the most least respected professions, according to Forbes magazine. There's a reason for that. But rather than accepting as a normal, I wanted to do something about it. I served 8 years to defend the Constitution. And I feel like the left is going too far to the left. And you know, some people are proud to call themselves socialists, and, you know, as a Korean American, we can see how socialism starts out in North Korea. And this is, you know, my parents came here, you know, to seek liberty, opportunity, and freedom. And I like to see the same opportunities are given to today's immigrants and the future of my children, my grandchildren.
Well, thanks for running. The 8th Congressional District of Virginia is probably geographically the most compact and the least gerrymandered of any district in Virginia. It's actually one of the few districts where you could probably go knocking door to door, walking streets. Is that something you've been doing during your campaign?
Yes, I've knocked on personally over 3,000 doors myself. I have a hole in my shoe right now to prove it. And the 8th District is very compact, but actually also we have a lot of, because it's more compact, there's more urban areas, there are a lot of buildings that you can't get into, such as high-rise condos, apartment buildings, so security, so you're not really, it's not like a single house family. But there are a lot of townhouses, too, where it's easier to go door-to-door knocking. Yeah, I would say it's not the most gerrymandered. I think the most gerrymandered would probably be the 11th District. I call it, it looks like an octopus if you look at it. I think 8th District looks basically like Jersey, but it covers Fairfax County, Arlington, Alexandria, and Falls Church City.
Well, I live in the 5th District, which is actually the size of New Jersey. So in comparison to the 8th District,
But the shape is about the same as New Jersey.
It's really, really huge. You face a daunting task. The 8th District is also the most Democratic district in Virginia, maybe one of the most Democratic districts in the country outside of Massachusetts. How do you approach that, running against an incumbent who also served in statewide office? And, you know, Hillary Clinton got something like 80% of the vote in the district in 2016. What's your approach to taking a Republican, conservative, or libertarian message to the voters?
Well, you know, statistically, by math-wise, you know, before you, you know, there's enough Republicans in the 8th district, if they all got up and vote today, that we could win, for example. And before the 8th district, back in the 1990s, when you were around, it was technically a Republican stronghold. I heard that the incumbent took it for granted, and we lost to the Democrats, and it's been Democrat for almost 30 years since then. I kind of see the same thing that's going on with the current incumbent. He takes his seat for granted. You will never see him knocking on doors. He doesn't show up to every forum that I've been invited to for the community that where he's also been invited to. I accepted all invitations, while he hasn't accepted them. Just prime example today, I was working with the African American Black community. I was invited, and he declined. What is he doing? And there's just other forums too for the Black, Hispanic, and Asian Chamber of Commerce. He's not there. So for me, you know, people, they say all politics is local, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of people see that day, and even if they're not a Democrat, they really appreciate me actually going out campaigning, and because they're like, that's the Democrat process, that's democracy. Whereas incumbent, you know, he's worth $120 million. He thinks he could just buy this election. And actually, based on that, a lot of Democrats are flipping against him. Veterans are voting for me because he voted against the VA Accountability Act, the VA Whistleblower Act. We have an 8% veteran population, which is huge considering that less than 1% of America served as our veterans now. So when people look at just discuss his voting record, because I said, hey, you know, regardless of what party you're from, I'm here to serve you and benefit the community and do what's best for you. And I currently feel that the incumbent hasn't been doing that. This area depends largely on the federal government because we're so close to the D.C. area. And so he also voted to shut down the federal government. So this is where it comes back to all politics is local. And like I said, I'm working to be a servant to everybody, and I think people appreciate that too. And, you know, I'm a libertarian Republican, and I'm also more towards the middle, so I understand everyone's kind of aspect too, you know, see both sides. I think framing is very important, but at the end of the day, I'm willing to listen to any group, any party affiliation, because I want to know what their concerns are, and I don't take running for office for granted. Unlike my opponent, he won't. You know, you write him an email or a letter, see how long it takes you to hear something back, or if you even hear back from him.
Your comments about Don Beyer being complacent about retaining his seat may resonate with people with very long memories, because back in 1990, when Stan Paris, Republican incumbent, was running for office, he didn't show up for any debates or forums. Jim Moran ended up debating empty chairs, and he won election and then served for the next 25 years. So you have a point there. Tell me a bit about your political philosophy and the sorts of issues that you're emphasizing during your campaign. What are you talking to voters about?
At the end of the day, you know, I believe that overall messaging is very important in framing, and you have to know who you're talking to as audience. I feel like overall many from both sides, people always try to force their ideas and ideologies, but at the end of the day, I respect people's ideologies. I said, well, here's what we can have. You know, for example, affordable housing is an issue because it's getting very urbanized. And if, for example, the median income is last time I checked, is $107,000 in the 8th district, which is huge. But there are a lot of people who actually don't even make half that in the 8th district. So,
well, the median income, half of the people are below that and half the people are above that.
Right. And it's such a wealthy area. And I say, well, affordable housing is something I talk about. That's typically something that Democrats talk about. And I say, well, I'm for affordable housing as well. And they're like, really? As a Republican? Yeah, why not? And they're like, well, because you're a Republican. I'm like, well, I'm a working class American. I'm not your typical megamillionaire politician. And actually, if affordable housing units are only a problem in Democrat areas, they're like, because they talk about, what do you need to stop gentrification, for example? And I said, well, the only cities with gentrification problems are cities where it's all Democrat one-party rule. Look at D.C., Alexandria City, Chicago, New York. Those areas are getting gentrified. But we're, as Republicans, or, you know, as libertarians, we expect the individual liberties and properties and rights. So we don't try to go take your home so a new home could be developed and you're pushed out of that neighborhood. And so I just think about what, because I believe from as human beings, we all want something positive at the end of the day. We just have a different way of getting there. And that's how I talk about it. I talk about having long-term solutions in general. Politicians, I think the American system is people always want short-term solutions, or they always talk about messaging bills. I mean, bills that don't mean anything, that never get to the Senate, but they just do it to get elected. I'm not very different from most politicians. I'm not a career politician. I'm a very straight shooter in the military. So whenever we're in a forum and there's a question, politicians will always try to skirt the question and say something of what they want to say. I never avoid a question, and I just be honest with, and be very truthful to them. And my biggest concern is the national debt, the almost 22 trillion, 21 point, like it's growing every day, every second. It's a huge issue, and that's an issue that everyone has coming to them, Republican or Democrat. And me as a 26-year-old, three denomination at 25 years old, that's an issue that resonates especially with the younger generation, because I was, hey, what are we going to do when we're retired? Do you know this country can be possibly bankrupt or collapse like the Soviet Union? They're like, that's a huge issue too. I also talk about everyday issues that relate to everyday American people, like traffic. There's, in D.C. area, there's huge traffic, there's potholes, and these are everyday issues that people resonate to. People who might not normally care about politics, they're like, well, if you can fix the potholes, you can build fix the traffic, I'll vote for you.
This last question has two parts. Mm-hmm. First part is, what political figure, living or dead, do you most admire? And the second part is, what politician who you usually disagree with on the issues do you still respect or admire?
I look at, you know, basic leadership philosophies. I respect, for example, Republicans. I respect Teddy Roosevelt. Abraham Lincoln, he was at the toughest decision as a Republican when the nation was divided. John McCain was the most, I guess, modern-day Republican that I respect the most. Some politicians on the opposite side that I respect would be, for example, Democrat Senator Chuck Schumer. Back when Maxine Waters, or she's still doing it now, is just trying to encourage the left to become a mob and just impeach 45 and just harass Republicans, you know, Chuck Schumer said, hey, there's a system called democracy for a reason. If you don't like someone, you vote. You vote them out, and you do it in a civil, peaceful way. And I respect that for Chuck Schumer as a Democrat. Another person I respect also, you know, currently in this current election will be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I disagree with her completely. I'm not a big fan of socialist ideas, as we both spoke, because my parents, you know, came from South Korea. But her work ethic, she doesn't take it for granted. And with the person when she was up against her in the primaries incumbent, it's the same thing that Don Beyer is doing right now. He didn't campaign. He took it for granted. So I admire her work ethic, yet even though I disagree with almost everything in her policy standpoint.
Well, thanks for that. Just to wind up, how can people find out more about your campaign? Do you have a website, Facebook, Twitter? How can people learn more about the Thomas O. campaign?
Yes, they can visit my website if they want to learn more or to support my campaign. My website is www.letschangecongress.org, L-E-T-S. changecongress.org, and they can follow me on Facebook or Twitter at O for Congress. O-H, that's how you spell my last name, so O for Congress.
2 weeks from now, on November 11th, we will mark the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended the First World War. Historian Garrett Peck has written a new book called The Great War in America, World War I and its Aftermath. Its official publication date is December 4th, but the score has a preview.
World War I, I think, is the most important war of the 20th century. And World War II gets all the attention, especially in the United States, because we liked the outcome from that war. We were the world superpower at the end of it, and the bad guys were really, really bad. And we kicked their butts. So we love World War II. World War I ends in this partisan quagmire between Senator Henry Cabot Lodge and President Wilson, neither of whom wanted to negotiate over the peace. And at the end, the United States basically walked away from our global role like a teenager who wasn't really ready to grow up yet and accept its global responsibilities. And as a result, we retreated back into isolationism. And so as a result, World War I becomes this huge lost opportunity to create a global framework for peace. And then we ended up having to fight that war again 2 decades later.
We're speaking with historian Garrett Peck, who is a prolific author. You've written about the history of alcoholic beverages, the history of the Potomac River, of the Smithsonian Castle. Now your new book is called The Great War in America. And it looks at the home front during World War I, which is something most people don't think about. The home front in World War II permeates American popular culture. You've got Woody Allen's film Radio Days, Meg Ryan's film Ithaca. People remember what it was like to live in the United States during the Second World War, whether you were in the service or not.
Yeah, the Ken Burns series.
Yeah, the Ken Burns series. So what was the home front like during World War I? How did people approach this first great foreign adventure of the United States military?
Yeah. There was a great deal of disaffection leading up into the war itself. The United States was really split over the question. You had a large group of, our biggest ethnic group period in the country were German Americans. Mm-hmm. And of course, they didn't want to go to war against England. They did not want to support England, I should say. Same thing for all the Irish Americans. They hated England because they had been suppressed by them for three centuries by this point. And they soon after the war was over, Ireland won its independence, 1921. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, you have a huge crowd of pro-Anglo people in the country who want to go help the Allies in this war. So the country was really split. We also had a huge number of pacifists. So it's really incredible. At that point, we had the Socialist Party of America, which was pacifist in nature. And, they strongly opposed the war because they saw this as war was simply just an extension of imperialism.
Well, there was a socialist from Milwaukee, my hometown, mm-hmm. who was elected to Congress. Victor Berger.
Yeah.
He was refused. The Congress refused to see him.
Yeah, they kicked him out, in fact.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he went back and got reelected.
He got reelected, which is incredible. Yeah. It was sort of disenfranchisement. Mm-hmm. New York State did the same thing, too. They had five or six socialist assemblymen. And the state assembly just booted them out, which was across the political spectrum, everyone was like, what the hell? Right? These were legally elected people.
And so, then you had Eugene Debs in jail running for president.
Because everyone got pardoned after the war except for Debs. President Wilson saw Debs as a personal betrayal because he had once been a presidential candidate and who in the summer of 1918 spoke out against the draft.
Right.
Had him imprisoned and refused to sign off on him, on unpardoning him.
But eventually President Harding did pardon him.
He did, yeah. So it's kind of incredible looking at the dissent within the country. We'd never really achieved national unity. And if anything, during the war itself, the Wilson administration, which was a leftist administration, effectively waged a war against the far left. Mm-hmm. So you had the Red Scare and the crackdown. You know, this fear that the Bolsheviks had arrived on our shores. And Mitchell Palmer, who was the Attorney General, went on this incredible... You could never see something like this happening today, I hope. Where he went and rounded up all the Reds, and without much due process at all. And fortunately, they did deport some of them, but the acting department, the head of the Labor Department, Secretary of Labor Lewis Post, began throwing out all the cases out, because the Department of Labor at that point controlled Ellis Island. And he was looking at all these cases and like, there's no due process here. There's no warrants. And whatnot. And he was like, okay, we're letting all these people go. But it's just incredible. There was no guardrails at that time. We really had not addressed had any significant First Amendment cases, not until 1919.
Right.
Yeah. The ACLU didn't exist yet. That's the American Civil Liberties Union.
The 100th anniversary of the ACLU is coming up in 2020.
Yeah. And it's a result of the war. Mm-hmm. And that's a significant guardrail in our society. But leading up into the war itself, none of those guardrails existed. It was just kind of incredible, like, to think a century ago. We did not have all of our civil liberties really framed out again yet. So it's a remarkable time.
And, of course, this is also the beginning of Prohibition, mm-hmm. which is your other field of expertise.
Yeah, and it's a direct result of the war.
Right, as is daylight savings time.
Yeah, boo, I want my hour back.
And the FBI, speaking of the Palmer raids, J. Edgar Hoover was a minor Justice Department functionary at the time mm-hmm. who became the head of the FBI, what became the FBI, and then served for another 50 years.
Yeah, it's incredible. Mitchell Palmer's career was sunk in the blowback from the Red Roundup, from the Red Scare, as it was called. And at the same time, J. Edgar Hoover, who actually led the raids, his career went into the stratosphere over this. You know, within a couple of years, he's essentially created the FBI, and now he leads it all the way until his death in 1972.
So this is all the legacy of the Great War.
Yeah.
Whether it would have happened anyway, we can't know. But what was home life for the people whose boys were sent overseas? What was it like to be a mother in the United States knowing that her son is fighting the Hun?
So to speak.
Right.
Yeah. Probably fairly similar in that sense to World War II, other than there's no rationing. In World War I, and by the way, we sent incredibly, we had like a little frontier army before the war, mm-hmm. Really set up to fight the Indians, even though the Indians threatened long
since. They were practicing with wooden rifles, weren't they?
Yeah. In some cases, we had virtually no armaments infrastructure for mm-hmm. producing artillery pieces and airplanes and tanks, that kind of stuff. We had to borrow them all from the Allies as we went into combat, which is incredible, right? World War II, we were much better prepared for.
In World War II, we became the arsenal of democracy.
Yeah. So in World War I, we still ended up sending 2 million soldiers to France, which is incredible. I think considering we had an army before the war started of about 107,000 people, kind of put in Panama and on the American frontier and the Philippines, and suddenly we draft 4.7 million young men and send them off to France, you know, half of them off to France, which is an incredible achievement, given we were only in the war for about a year and a half.
And this was in the face of draft riots, people mm-hmm. opposing the draft at that time.
Yeah, there weren't really any riots per se.
It was not like there were in
the
Civil
War. No, yeah. There were slacker raids, though, which is another jaw-dropping event that happens in September of 1918, where effectively a vigilante group called the American Protective League, they're brought in by the Justice Department to check all the draft cards of all these young men around the corner, around the country, I should say. And they detained them if you did not have your draft card. I mean, draft cards are brand new, so many people would have, you know, register for the draft, wait for their date to call, so they left their cards at home. Voila, you come walking out of work, and there's some guy with a badge saying, "Show me your draft card." "Oh, you don't have it. Okay, well, you're going to come along with me." And they rounded up thousands of men and held them at armories all around the country until they could prove that they had registered for the draft.
And this is at a time when most people didn't have any form of ID at all. Mm-hmm. There were no driver's licenses. There were no social security cards.
Yeah.
So this would have caught people completely by surprise.
Totally. I mean, the law did say you were supposed to carry your draft card with you, but who had ever experienced that before, right? Did it really matter? This, by the way, was called the slacker raids because it was intended to catch slackers. In other words, draft dodgers. It caught very few draft dodgers. Most young men registered for the draft. And those who did not want to register for the draft, they had an alternative. We did, in fact, have conscientious objectors at that time. But most people who were slackers could go into one of the vital industries, for example, shipbuilding, mm-hmm. Or working in munitions or factories where we actually needed, or coal mines. Those people were exempt. So you could get a job without having to go into the military, and you were exempt from the draft.
What did the soldiers bring back from the war that you know, ideas what did they learn fighting overseas that affected their lives when they came back home?
Mm-hmm. Certainly they brought lots of souvenirs back home with them and so on. But I think most of the soldiers were very proud of their experience, but within a couple of years, the country really turned their backs on the war. Certainly by like 1921, 1922, most Americans thought being involved in the war was a mistake. And so, yeah.
Really sort of the way people think today about Iraq.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's sort of the same time frame.
Mm-hmm. And so we effectively just walked away from it. And at the same time, the veterans did organize themselves. This is where the American Legion comes mm-hmm. about, and they created a veterans lobby, and they were, you know, very important. We also had the precursor to the VA. The Veterans Administration was founded during this time.
Right.
To help out with veteran services.
And the veterans budget became a very big issue in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in 1932, you got the Bonus Army marching on Washington.
Yeah.
And Douglas MacArthur, you know, basically shooting them all.
Yeah. You know, gas and whatnot to evict them from their camps over on the Anacostia Flats.
After a break, we will hear the rest of my interview with Garrett Peck and learn about both influenza and Herbert Hoover. Later, economist Christine McDaniel will discuss the pluses and minuses of the trade deal with Canada and Mexico. Don't touch that dial. The Score will return in a few moments.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm Rick Sincere. Before the break, we were talking with historian Garrett Peck about his new book on World War I. Let's pick up where we left off.
There are two other aspects of World War I and the time period around it that I want to find out whether you address in the book. One was the Spanish flu epidemic, mm-hmm. and two was the great humanitarian effort organized by Herbert Hoover mm-hmm. that launched him into his public service career.
Yeah, yes, I covered both.
Yeah, so let's talk about the flu first.
Yeah, the so-called Spanish influenza, and it's called that. The flu actually is believed to originate in Kansas. And got transferred over to Europe through sick doughboys. Mm-hmm. They were put on ships, they had the flu, they carried it with them, and this was the greatest and most terrible pandemic ever in the world history. More people died from this, including 625,000 Americans, from a population of only about 110 million people in the country at the time. It's pretty deadly, this pandemic.
There were more people who died from the flu during that period than died from war wounds.
Correct. We had 116,000 soldiers who were killed during the war. The majority of them were killed by the flu.
Wow.
Not German bullets. So it's just remarkable how deadly this flu was. It actually came in three waves. The first one in the spring of 1918, they got a lot of people sick, but then they were okay after that. Very few people died from that. And then they had immunity. And then the next one was in about September 1918, right as the brutal fighting gets going in the final offensive. Just both sides, all the armies, everyone was just deathly ill while they were doing all this fighting. Incredible.
Yeah, it must have been a remarkable time period. But Herbert Hoover, what did he do to feed Europe?
Yeah, Hoover had this, he was an incredible technocrat. Not a guy with a whole lot of great personality, but he knew, he had great humanitarian instincts.
And he was an engineer.
Mm-hmm. Who had made his fortune working in Australia, and at the time when the war broke out, he was living in the UK. And so he stepped up during the war, when he saw that the Germans had invaded Belgium, and Belgium is even to this day, is completely reliant upon foreign imports for food. It cannot feed itself, just like the UK can't feed itself. And so he immediately created this committee for Belgian relief to bring foodstuffs. So all the food was shipped in through Rotterdam, because the Germans never occupied the Netherlands. And he had good relations with the Germans. And by this, he was able to feed, I think, 9 million people in Belgium and in northern France who are behind German lines. So he kept that many people alive during the war for basically 4.5 years. He fed them. Incredible. And large, all done through private enterprise, basically. He privately fundraised. After the war was over, he actually went with President Wilson, to the Paris Peace Conference, and then he headed up, well, during the war itself, by the way, he headed up the Food Administration during the United States, for the United States. So we had meatless Mondays and wheatless Wednesdays, that kind of stuff. We never had rationing. He just encouraged people, using effectively social pressure, to limit their food.
And to eat Salisbury steak instead of hamburger.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Things like that, right? World War II, we have rationing. But World War I, we don't. So it's basically it's voluntary during the mm-hmm. war. And as I mentioned, going back to what I had said a minute ago about Hoover went with Wilson to the Paris Peace Conference, and there he headed up all the relief agencies to basically feed most of Europe, because most of the European economies had collapsed at the end, and you had just tens of millions of starving people. And so part of this whole process, you know, before we ever had like the Marshall Plan, was to figure out how to get people to that first winter when you're right after the war, when a lot of crops hadn't been sown. It was a really, really cold winter. And how do you keep Europe from starving to death and also keep Europe from turning Bolshevik?
Right.
Because people who are starving don't make good Democrats.
And we forget that the United States sent troops into Russia after the war to fight the Bolsheviks.
Exactly.
This is an underreported part of American history.
Yeah, they basically didn't really have any kind of mission, and these were terrible missions that they had. One was to go to Arkhangel, and they occupied, and they were there over the winter. So this is in the Arctic Circle. And the soldiers had no idea why they were there or anything. The other group was sent to Vladivostok. That's where the so-called Czech Legion was. So 50,000 Czech Slovaks who were waiting for ships to take them all the way around the world to get back to Europe so they could then fight the Germans. They had taken over the Trans-Siberian Railroad and made their way to Vladivostok. Wilson sent in about 7,000 doughboys into Vladivostok to keep the Japanese, who were also going to send a force in, from making a land grab at Russia, given just the chaos of the Russian Civil War.
So and the Japanese had just defeated the Russians 13 years earlier.
1905, yeah.
For basically the same territory. Mm-hmm. That's what they were fighting over.
Exactly. And Wilson wanted to make sure the Russians did not seize more Russian territory.
Right. We're running out of time, so I just want to find out where you got the idea for writing this book and how did you pitch it to your publisher?
Yeah. The book, it's been in my craw for quite a number of years, and I finally thought, as we were approaching, well, with the start of World War I itself, the centennial of the war, that was about the time I thought I should really get busy working on this book. So about 2014, I got involved more heavily in it, so it took about a 3.5-year process to write it and research it. It was a huge research project. I was really aiming for something like James McPherson's The Battle Cry of Freedom. Mm-hmm. So essentially a summary history of the war. You know, I cannot tell every single soldier's experience of the war. You would end up with a 6-volume book if you did that, and no one would want to read that.
Right.
So I was really aiming for a summary of the key issues that happened during the war and also the unintended consequences of the war. So I cover the race riots of 1919, the first Red Scare, which we talked about a bit ago, suffrage, which is an outcome from the war, and also prohibition, start of all that. So all the things that would have never happened had it not been for the war itself. And, of course, we also get the ACLU.
Work mostly with primary sources?
Overwhelmingly with primary sources, of which there's many, many biographies. I use the New York Times quite a bit because, then as now, they are the newspaper of record for the country. And when you're just looking for the basic facts and people who've been quoted and stuff, it's in the Times, which is really cool. So I used Woodrow Wilson's papers. And I'm on the board of the Woodrow Wilson House, so I had access to those. Uh-huh. They're in the Library of Congress. And then a lot of cabinet secretaries' diaries, that kind of stuff. So it's overwhelmingly primary documentation. I really wanted to go back to the sources and tell the story and interpret it myself because it really is an overlooked war, which is really unfortunate in American history.
Just to go full circle, at the beginning of our conversation, you noted that the war was divisive, unpopular. A few years later, people just wanted to pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Does that explain why there is no World War I memorial in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, that's a big factor. And in fact, there is a national World War I museum and memorial, and it is in all places, Kansas City, Missouri.
Really?
Yes, because it's a great place. It's because after the war was over, there was a commission that was putting together this memorial, and they were trying to find a city that would take it, and D.C. didn't want it. You had all these other cities that were asked. Kansas City was the only one that would take it. So out there in the American heartland is the national memorial. Now, then, there is a commission today, the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission, and they have the charter to go out there and get and build a World War I memorial, national memorial for the war and the veterans, and it's going to be on Pershing Square in Washington, Pershing Park,
right,
in Washington D.C.
Well, there is an obscure local memorial to the war in Washington, but it's just to veterans who served who were from Washington D.C. And most people would never see it if they came here as a tourist.
Yeah, it's very true, and it's a beautiful little memorial. It's called the D.C. War Memorial. and has the 499 people who died during the war all listed in alphabetical order. And amazingly, given that D.C. had Jim Crow law at the time, people are not spelled out by race. You see so many other memorials, including we're in Arlington, Virginia right now. We have a war memorial, and it shows the very top level, shows, you know, all the soldiers, and the ones below, it mentions colored soldiers. So you still see that in the South especially. There's still the segregation at work. The D.C. War Memorial does not have that on there. It's simply just alphabetical order, women and men included. There are 12 women they're all listed all the way around in a ring. All the soldiers and Marines and Coast Guardsmen and whatnot, yeomanettes as the women were called at the time, who died during the war.
Well, congratulations on the new book. As I noted before we got on the air, it's the thickest of your books so far, so I imagine it was a real project, and I'm looking forward to reading it myself.
Thanks so much, Rick. Yeah, thank you, and I loved every minute of writing this book.
Well, thanks, Garrett Peck, for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Over the past few months, The Score has homed in on trade policy issues. This week, we have a return appearance by Christine McDaniel, an economist at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I spoke to Dr. McDaniel at her office in Arlington earlier this week and asked her for her assessment of the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement called the USMCA.
Just a few weeks ago, I was talking to your colleague, Dan Griswold, about the USMCA, which had just been announced. Nobody had seen a text of it. So now we've had an opportunity to actually look at what the treaty is. And I'm just wondering what your initial impressions are for NAFTA 2.0 or the USMCA, whatever we might call it, on a trade agreement between the United States and Canada and the United States and Mexico and Canada and Mexico. What does it look like?
Well, so it looks very similar to NAFTA 1.0, and it's also almost a hybrid between NAFTA 1.0 and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I would say, with some tweaks, some non-trivial tweaks. In some sense, it was looking at it, it was sort of anticlimactic because after all of the heated trade rhetoric we all went through for so long across the North America region, it didn't look like they achieved that much more market access, if you will. That said, there were a lot of other non-tariff issues that apparently were more important to the administration to be worked out, and it does appear that they were able to come to an agreement with their Canadian and Mexican counterparts on those issues.
We're talking with Christine McDaniel, a trade policy analyst at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Just yesterday, you had a piece in The Hill about how the new NAFTA, USMCA, can help leverage our trade arrangements with China. Could you summarize what that's all about? Because I don't think most people would associate a North American free trade agreement, a U.S.-Canadian-Mexican free trade agreement, with China. What's the deal with that?
Right. So USMCA has a clause in it, Article 3210, which basically says that if any one of the parties intends to enter into trade negotiations with a non-market economy, basically China, then they must let the others know. And after they do let the others know, then the others can review that agreement and then, you know, reassess whether or not everybody wants to stay inside the USMCA or not. And that, you know, that is really the first time that we've ever had a clause in our trade agreement like that. So it took a lot of people off guard, I think. But then I thought, you know, when you step back and take a look at everything that's going on around us right now, and the elephant in the room really is China. And it's not even so much China as it is the non-market economy practices that China has. And that is what's really caused a stir. Just owing to the country's sheer size, you know, whenever the Chinese government decides to prioritize a particular sector, owing to the country's sheer size, a massive amount of labor and capital go into that sector. And then you get this big production surge, and that production does spill over, you know, onto the global economy, and it can send ripple effects across borders. And that disruption has I think, been the cause of a lot of the pushback that we've seen in the U.S. and frankly, other countries on international trade.
A country like China, while it has some market elements, it still is very much a state-directed economy. And this was illustrated in an article I saw a couple days ago in the Washington Post about how the Chinese government has decided to push production of and export of some liquor that is a specialty of China that nobody else in the world drinks, but they want to make it a competitor to scotch or bourbon or vodka. Is this the sort of thing that the negotiators of the USMCA might have had in mind?
Something like that, yes. Here's the thing. It's not that China is large or not. You know, it's not even that, you know, it really doesn't have anything to do with the Chinese country per se. It's their non-market economy practices that can be quite disruptive. And that, you know, a real theoretical economist might say, well, the proper response to, you know, a foreign government wanting to, you know, subsidize something and have those other taxpayers pay for it, the proper response would be a thank you note. But in reality, we don't really see a lot of thank you notes, right? Yeah. So, for example, the U.S. taxpayers, we have not seen a thank you note for us subsidizing sugar and keeping world sugar prices low. U.S., we haven't sent the European taxpayers a thank you note for Airbus, you know, given to the extent that the European governments subsidize Airbus and so on and so forth. So, in reality, we don't have thank you notes. Instead, what we do is we put on tariffs and other trade regulations, and that just ends up shooting ourselves in the foot. So, remember what the Obama administration wanted to do. You know, they recognized these non-market economy issues. They recognized the importance of them. And in addressing them. And that was what the Trans-Pacific Partnership was supposed to be about, right? It was supposed to be about getting agreement on these key issues like subsidies, state-owned enterprises, intellectual property theft, other issues, getting agreement on those key issues that are largely outside of the WTO's reach, I would say, and reining in China that way. The Trump administration, of course, they pulled us out of the TPP, and they've pursued this other approach. So, you know, big picture, every administration has their own way of dealing with China, but, you know, and this administration has chosen, you know, the strategy for now. That said, I don't think it's unreasonable to have that clause in the USMCA at this point in time, because so many countries are discussing WTO reform, you know, global trade rule reform. How are we going to deal with these issues that really weren't addressed, you know, when China joined the WTO, like state-owned enterprises, subsidies, other non-market economy practices? The EU, Japan, the United States right now, for the past few months, have in the background been discussing how to reform global trade rules. Canada has put forth a white paper. The Europeans have put forth a white paper. There have been other countries involved in this as well. So, you know, there's a lot of movement behind the scenes right now on reforming global trade rules. So I don't think it's unreasonable to put that clause in there that basically says, hey, let's get these other rules sorted out. Until we do, let's agree, the three of us, to be on the same page regarding non-market economy practices.
Even though the United States pulled out of the TPP, the other partners in the Trans-Pacific Partnership are going through with the agreement. Are they going to be able to provide the kind of balance against China, even in the absence of the United States, that the trade world needs?
Well, we'll see. I mean, we've never been in this situation before in largely uncharted waters. Usually the United States has been one of the key leaders on global trade rules, the U.S. and EU. and others Japan. So we're, you know, we're largely putting a pause on that. That said, the president has said that he would be open to getting back to the TPP at some point. So I'm hopeful that they'll keep our seat warm for us and that they'll continue on with the chapters as they were written, especially the key important ones. And maybe even, you know, down the road when we are ready to re-enter, then we can revisit some of those key chapters. And by then, some of the WTO reform issues will have made some progress. And maybe TPP might even be stronger than we had hoped. So, you know, I'm still optimistic.
Considering all of this, the TPP, the clause in the USMCA about non-market economies, does that provide leverage to get China to liberalize its economy?
Well, China's... I like to look at this in terms of, you know, what is in a country's incentive. What is in China's incentive right now is to maintain market access to large economies, to large markets across the world. If you look at how important the WTO is to different countries, a recent survey I was just looking at, that Chinese citizens have a much more favorable view in terms of the importance of the WTO than Americans. That's because I think it reflects how much China has really benefited from being part of the World Trade Organization. So it's really in China's interest to stay in the WTO, for the WTO to keep functioning. And, you know, and I think in a lot of ways, you know, when the U.S. and many other countries feel that China didn't really live up to its promises back in 2001 when they joined the WTO. You know, there was a lot of hope that they would move more toward privatization away from state-owned enterprises. And they started doing that, but then after President Xi Jinping took office, he really stalled and you could even say took a U-turn on some of those reforms and has really centralized state power and the state's role in the economic planning. And that's what's causing real problems in the global trading regime.
Just to wrap up, we only have about 30 seconds left. What are the next steps we can expect in terms of the USMCA getting NAFTA back on track?
Well, we'll see. Congress is looking over the deal now. We're talking to them about certain aspects that they have questions about. There'll be their own processes there. I know that Canada and Mexico are very keen to get out from under the Section 232 tariffs on steel and aluminum. I think that might be a nice trade-off, you know, to once we do wrap up USMCA, then to lift the steel and aluminum tariffs off of our close neighbors and allies. That's probably first on the agenda. And then, you know, as the USTR Lighthizer has recently announced, we'll be looking forward to engaging in trade negotiations with other countries, Japan, the EU, others. So, you know, I'm looking forward to having the Congress vet this agreement, approve it, and then moving on to, you know, increasing market access for U.S. companies in other countries as well.
Well, thank you very much for joining us again on The Score. Christine McDaniel of the Mercatus Center, it's always a pleasure to talk to you because you really know your stuff.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Earlier in the show, we had an extended interview with historian Garrett Peck about the First World War. In this recording from the archives, I talked to him about Prohibition, one of the results of that war. As it happens, our conversation took place in the Woodrow Wilson House, where the president who led the United States into war lived after his term ended. From the archives, here's Garrett Peck in May 2011.
What's the origin of the book? How did it come about?
Well, I lead a tour called the Temperance Tour, which is of Prohibition-related sites in Washington, D.C., which I started 5 years ago in May 2006. And then I thought at some point, you know, I've got enough material here that I can actually turn this into a book. And so I expanded it to cover the entire story of Prohibition in D.C.
And how did you start your research? Where did you go first?
I used primary research, and I had a lot of material already. I had a number of people, because I lead the temperance tour, so I kind of knew where the stuff was already. The first chapter I wrote was actually The Man in the Green Hat, and that's the chapter I used to sell the book to the publisher. And so I used a lot of primary material, so the Washington Post online archives. I went to the D.C. Public Library and, you know, dug through microforms of, you know, different newspapers and so on. Mm-hmm. There's actually a lot of biographies from the 1920s, so mm-hmm. I used a lot of those. Just probably 90% of the book is primary research.
What's the most surprising or unexpected thing you came across as you were working on the book?
A couple things. The size of the brewing industry before Prohibition, which was huge, and then just seeing it just collapse with Prohibition, that was really surprising. I wrote a chapter on African Americans in Washington, D.C. during Prohibition, and sort of, you know, no one ever wrote about them because the press was segregated at the time. So that was probably actually about half my research time, and just trying to come up with an answer for, you know, what did black people think about Prohibition, and that really surprised me, how difficult it was to research that topic. And then the kind of the back-to-back story of Rufus Lusk and George Cassidy coming out within a month of each other. So the first guy writing the Speakeasy Map and the second one spilling the beans about bootlegging for Congress in, you know, 1930 had a huge impact for the wet cause and, you know, helped shift the country towards repeal.
Now, you noted in your remarks earlier that the number of speakeasies was about 10 times the number of bars and saloons prior to Prohibition. Does that make sense?
I think it does from an economic standpoint, yes. I mean, it was an economic opportunity for a lot of people, you know. People still wanted to drink, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, supply and demand. If there's people who want to drink, well, there's demand, and there's going to be people who are going to meet that supply. So, yeah, plenty of people realized, hey, I can make a good living off of selling booze to people in, you know, and whether it's in my apartment or if I set up a club. A lot of here in D.C., we had just a lot of apartments mm-hmm. or, you know, a room above a business, so it looked like it was legit, you know.
Now, how does that 3,000 speakeasies compare to the number of drinking establishments in D.C. today?
I'm not certain how many we actually have here in D.C. today. They had 300 before Prohibition. I think it's well over 500 in the city today, but 3,000 would definitely be a lot more than we actually have today, I think, in the city. I'm not certain of the exact number, but, I mean, the city controls liquor licenses, and, you know, a lot of neighborhoods don't want any more, you know, because they mm-hmm. don't want to become a bar scene,
right.
and where they are.
You mentioned your chapter on African-Americans, which I thought was really interesting, but it brings to mind a question about two possibilities of communities you didn't talk about as much, which I'm wondering whether it's just because of a lack of documentary material, mm-hmm. and that would be college students mm-hmm. on the one hand, and you also had a few tantalizing mentions of gay bars, mm-hmm. but beyond that, you don't have much in there.
Yeah.
Is that another book coming out? Or?
Probably not, no. gay bars at the time were not well documented in the city, and there still has to be sort of an official history of gay D.C. written. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine actually works at the Library of Congress is going to be writing that history using Frank Kameny's papers, which mm-hmm. I'm just like, which he donated to the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. I'm thrilled that he's going to be doing this book. And so, yeah, there's still a lot of exploration still to do in that particular topic. Also, there were certainly, this has always been a college town, you know, so a lot of the college students I, you know, did find were in fact bootlegging. It was an opportunity for people to, you know, essentially to pay for their tuition, you know, by bootlegging booze.
Because looking at Georgetown today, or like even in the 1970s, you'd expect that in the 20s and 30s it might have had mm-hmm. a vibrant culture of
mm-hmm.
the town.
I'm sure it did.
One of the things I thought about as I was reading the book was that there could be a whole series here of prohibition in X city, mm-hmm. prohibition in St. Louis, prohibition mm-hmm. in Milwaukee, prohibition in Buffalo.
Yeah.
Do you think your publisher would be interested in something like that? And if they approached you, would you be interested in writing a book about another city?
I'll probably stick with D.C. D.C. is a city I know best, but I would certainly encourage historians in those other cities, especially where there's like a known, what's the term for that? Where they know, in fact, there was a huge prohibition culture going on during Prohibition, for other local historians to explore those questions, you know. I mean, I think, you know, Cleveland could write a story. Detroit could certainly write a story. You know, Boston. Each one could definitely tell its own story about how the mayhem unfolded in their particular city. So I would definitely encourage that. And I think the History Press would probably love to see more proposals like that, you know.
Yeah, I wish I could write it.
Yeah.
Last question is, we're here at the Woodrow Wilson House tonight. What's the relationship relationship? How did you happen to have your book launch party here as opposed to somewhere else?
It felt really natural to have it here. This is the final, last official stop on the Temperance Tour. And there is a Prohibition era wine cellar that's here in the house, and he was the president when Prohibition began, and it's just a wonderful space. It's a 12,000 square foot house with a really nice garden, I brought so many people here over the years. I've been doing the tour, so when I approached them about having the party here, they were like, "Yes, absolutely." So this felt. I didn't even think of any other place to have the party. This is where I wanted to have it. And
is your book going to be on sale in the book or in the gift shop here?
It is. In fact, it's in the gift shop right now. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Great.
And it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Yeah. Exactly.
Of course.
That's all the time we have for The Score this week. We'll be back next week with a film review from Tim Halsey and some predictions about the outcome of this year's midterm elections. In the meantime, for all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to tell your friends where to find us and listen again for The Score's news, reviews, and interviews.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.